We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.
Thank you for coming back to the Quick Restart Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined as always by Quint Kesnick, who is fresh off of March Madness, the College Wrestling Championship, home from St. Louis and catching up on the world of lacrosse. But before we hear from Quint about what his thoughts were on the past weekend in college lacrosse, Quint, how was the wrestling championship?
Well, it's fascinating, interesting. It was like no other assignment I've ever done in that I had to fly on Monday for an event that was Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I had to test before I flew. I had to test twice once arriving in St. Louis. I was tier one, so I was with the athletes and the coaches. And then once the session started, I was not allowed to interact with people on my crew. No, I was the only tier one on our crew. So my producer, I never saw in person, talked to him on the phone, saw him across the arena. I really had no interaction with people, with the other announcers, other than waving to them. I slept and lived in a room in the arena for 3 days, basically, in between sessions. They spread this event out, Terry, you know, so instead of just having like one session that lasts 3 hours, they opened it up. So they cut that in half. So they had two sessions that lasted an hour and a half to provide more cleaning, locker rooms, hallways, mats. So I was at the arena for like 14 hours a day, sleeping in this little cubbyhole in the bowels of the stadium in between sessions. So it was very different, very exhausting, tremendous, loved it. And I think the takeaway for lacrosse fans is we can do this, okay? 330 athletes, all negative tests prior, all negative tests on site, all negative tests throughout, coaches included, not a single positive test, okay? There's no reason that without good testing, lacrosse season shouldn't continue on and gain strength and traction.
There's another lesson for lacrosse fans to take away, which is that player personalities, nothing can promote the sport more than that. AJ Ferrari and Spencer Lee both putting in very memorable post-match interviews. What do you take away from those interactions?
That's a good point. You know, Penn State had four national champions, but there's a human connection there, you know, and I think we can do a better job of storytelling across the board on the TV side of things. You know, I still think there's more there that we can do to tell the great stories of a Tehoga Nanacoke or a Michael Sowers. Everybody's got a story. And so, you know, having access to those student athletes during this tournament was great. I mean, they're like lightning rods. They connect with people. They make people laugh. They make people smile. They make people want to cheer them on. They make people want to hate them. But they stir human emotion. I had a great time with these wrestlers. Gosh, they're pieces of work, to say the least.
Let's get down to business. It was week six in college lacrosse, and we've now kind of gone through this ping pong where 2 weeks ago, it was a little bit of a lackluster week. Last week, it was awesome. This week, a little lackluster. Next week, gonna be awesome. But as a result, a couple things that we're gonna inject into this as opposed to soliciting your comments. I have assigned a hot button topic that is kind of a lightning rod in conversations around this sport to each game, and we are going to build on top of that with getting your thoughts, Quint, about some of these hot button issues. And in addition to that, it is goalie week on Inside Lacrosse, so I'm going to weave a few aspects of goalie play into the conversation, which is a nice segue to dovetail to the first game that I wanted to talk about. It was at noon on the ACC Network. Syracuse hosted Holy Cross in a medicine game and came away with a 15-6 victory over the Crusaders. It took 14 minutes for Syracuse to get their first goal, but ultimately it was Owen Hiltz feeding and Chase Scanlon finishing. Scanlon finished with 7 goals, Hiltz with 5 assists. Patrick McEwen of Inside Lacrosse rewatched the game on Sunday and made an interesting comment, which is he thought that Syracuse's offense really struggled to adapt to Holy Cross's over-aggressive defensive approach, which will be an interesting thing to watch as we go forward. But before we get into some of the topics around both Syracuse as they turn their attention to Duke in the Thursday night thriller, coming down the pipe very fast, as well as some of the other aspects of this game that we can discuss in terms of the lead-up to their matchup against the Crusaders, we certainly need to hear from Paul Carpetera in terms of what it meant to honor Rob Cavavit, his childhood, lifelong best friend, and let's go ahead and play two clips from that broadcast.
before today's game, a moment of silence for Cavo. Rob Cavovit, the former All-American and national champion at Syracuse. We said it at the top of the broadcast, the difficulty for us today, and certainly my broadcast partner, Paul Carcaterra. We have to cover this story because it is such a big story for Syracuse University and SU lacrosse and the lacrosse community. But, Paul, this hits you, I know, on a personal level because you guys grew up together from Yorktown to Syracuse, roommates and best friends.
Yeah, there's been a lot of tears this week and more to come for sure. And I just think from playing in his backyard with the floodlight on to moving in together freshman year in college, he was always there. His family helped raise me. From the first stick I picked up to the last shot, he was always there. We won 3 state championships in high school, a national title in college. We captained teams together. In sports, certain players are responsible for the success of others, and he made me. I was lost without him, Anish, on the field. But more importantly, the same can be said for off the field. He made me so much better, and I was lost without him when he wasn't around growing up. He was unassuming. He was kind. He was gentle. He was caring. He was an amazing listener, and he didn't want to be the center of a conversation. I always took the air out of the room, and he was okay with that. He just wanted to see others happy, and he gave our friendship everything. Everything. And I love him for that. And I will always love him. And there are 2 little boys in Florida named Landry and Luke Cavovit. And they love this game just like their dad, and they'll use this game as medicine and play with their father's spirit and passion. And I know they will, and I can't wait to watch.
Spoken like a teammate, spoken like a friend. They'll honor his legacy here. They'll remember him. When you're an all-time great at Syracuse, that's like being one of the greatest painters of the Renaissance. That's what Rob Cavovit was, and to Kark, so much more. I know it's been a tough week for you since you got the news. That was your best friend. You've told me, though, lacrosse has been therapeutic for you, watching, calling games, medicine game.
100%. Now, I have a connection with the Creator's Game, and I've read about the Creator's Game, and I didn't grow up Native American or on a reservation to feel that power in terms of the generations before me. My mother and father are from New York City. So every time I go up to Syracuse, Anish, I'd like to see Coach Simmons. Last year I couldn't because of COVID and the season got cut short. 2 years ago, I asked Coach Simmons if he wanted to go out for breakfast. He said, absolutely, like we always did. He said, can I bring Alfie Jock with me? And Alfie is a Native American who lives on the Onondaga Nation, and he's known throughout the lacrosse world for making the most gorgeous, beautiful sticks from tree to finished products, all through nature. And we meet Alfie out for breakfast, and after breakfast, I go back to Alfie's house with Coach Simmons, and we stay with Alfie for a while. We go into his workroom, and I see the process firsthand. And I ask him if he would make me a stick. This is 2 years ago. He said, absolutely. Anish, I've told you this, and I want to tell everyone else. If you don't believe there's medicine in this game, and if you don't believe that the Creator is looking after us, that stick arrived at my house on Wednesday, the day after Rob died.
All right, Quinn, obviously you've gotten to know Kark tremendously well as a broadcast partner over the last decade. You learned of Rob Cavovit's death the way that so many of us did through messages and the like early in the week, and were able to share a little bit with Paul. What was your reaction to this news?
I was shocked, and it makes me Cavo was 1995 was my first NCAA championship game. I remember specifically with Leaf, we were talking about the Syracuse roster, and I kept getting back, coming back to this guy, Kavovit, because he was such a consistent producer. I mean, it was 2-2, 3-1, 1-3, he could do it all. You know, lacrosse is a game. It's the fabric that holds so many of these relationships together. It's the birth of so many relationships in my life and Clark's life. And it can be a healing mechanism. And, you know, when you're out on the lacrosse field, when I lost my dad in high school, you know, I was wrestling and I was very angry. And I carried it onto the mat and that wasn't a good thing. And then lacrosse season hit and you're out on the lacrosse field in the sun. And there's a certain healing quality of this game because I think it grabs your attention. You have to concentrate on the ball and the stick. And so it takes your mind off what you're doing. And so lacrosse has always been healing for me. And hopefully it is for the Cavett family, for Clark, and for all those who played and loved and followed Rob.
I mentioned it's goalie week. We can't start without talking about AJ Fox, the goalie in this game, who finished with 18 saves. He was absolutely phenomenal. Comparisons to Liam Entenmann in terms of his stance, style, and approach, I think are not baseless. He does have that kind of reminiscent quality in terms of being tall and thin. But as I mentioned, I felt like Syracuse as shooters really allowed themselves to settle for long-range shots because they weren't getting the types of looks off dodges that they're used to getting because of Holy Cross's quick support. They turn their attention to Duke, and, you know, I don't want to say Duke is the slowest sliding team in college lacrosse, but they certainly are a team that, if they like a matchup, will be slow to go. And so I wonder tactically and strategically how that turns this attention forward. Duke is coming off of a bye week, haven't, you know, really been tested in a couple of weeks. What are your expectations for this? Monumental matchup.
Well, Duke's defense has been getting a little better and better and better. They're really happy with the play of JT Giles Harris, Tyler Carpenter, and Brower.
Kenny Brower
is kind of the guy Kenny Brower is really the guy who's emerged as a lefty. They put him on Ashton Rolting. They view him really as their number one cover guy, which frees up JT to make some plays off the ball. Now, early in the year, I don't love their shorties. They're good. I don't love them. So I think they're going to have to get in the sliding business. And I saw a little more of that over the last couple of weeks. But in no way has this group been tested. In no way has this defense been tested with what they're going to face now over the next five or six games. So, you know, that ability of that those shorties, their ability in the middle of the field still, to me, is in question. I've liked their operation in the half field set offensively and defensively. Really good. Jake Naso facing off, really good. Adler in the pipes, really good. But tying it all together. So, again, it's that core work. You know, they got the nice upper body. They got the beautiful calves like Cotter. What's their core? What's their middle of the field game tying the legs and the upper body together going to look like? And we get answers. This is a great time of year now in the ACC as you get all these Thursday night thriller games that take center stage.
I mentioned hot-button topics. This one is more pointed and more specific than most are, but one of the conversations on social media all week was Lehigh trying to get a game after COVID issues had derailed their schedule for this weekend, yeah, and posting publicly on Twitter, will anybody play us? And certainly with Syracuse being about and 90-minute drive, and that's 2 hours. 2 hours drive from Lehigh's campus. It seems like a logical fit. Lehigh was very limited in terms of where they could travel on the basis of their campus policies and geography. So it was a good fit for the Mountain Hawks, but ultimately Syracuse decided to play Holy Cross. The hot-button topic, did John Desko and the Orange duck Lehigh? And follow-up, is it okay, given that they had a short week coming up against arguably the best team in the nation?
Yes and yes.
Well said.
If they wanted to play Lehigh, they would have. It was a no-win situation. They have nothing to gain by playing Lehigh. Had they had a easier game maybe on the following Saturday, the 27th, perhaps they would have scheduled it. But in this situation, playing Lehigh on short prep with the Mountain Hawks playing really well with a great offense and a dangerous Fogo and a great goalie, James Spence, they had nothing to gain here, so I'm going to give them a mulligan. We'll see how this turns out Selection Sunday when Cuse and Lehigh are slotted into the bracket. Could make for an interesting first-round game.
in an effort not to talk exclusively about the Big Ten, let's typewriter back to Tuesday.
Anything to talk about in the Big Ten other than Maryland and Rutgers?
I've got a couple things I want to talk about in the Big Ten. But let's first talk about Denver 13, Georgetown 7. Yeah, this was a game that you had circled because you took much more of a wait-and-see approach on the Hoyas than most of the poll voters. And you came away feeling better about Georgetown, I think, than you did going in. Not necessarily on the basis of what you saw, but more so on the basis of your expectation for their improvement coming away from this game.
Well, like, the average fan looks at Georgetown and says, wow, they beat Villanova week one 16-1. They're really great. And they're not really watching their body of work. You got to watch the tape, folks. You got to watch the highlight clips when you can. And watching the Mount St. Mary's game, when I'm watching for the first 5 minutes and I couldn't tell who was in white and who was in blue, who was Mount St. Mary's and who was Georgetown, that kind of told me right away that this team should not be ranked fourth in the country. Okay. Finally, I figured out who was who in that game because of the web stream announcers. And then you watch their personnel and you learn their personnel. That being said, that was an impossible situation, Terry. I mean, a Tuesday afternoon game, travel that was impacted, a game that was pushed down the line for a couple days. And I thought they accounted themselves pretty darn well. Denver's improved dramatically, okay, especially defensively. They've got the offensive pieces in the right spot, tough face-off game, improved goaltending play. Denver looks like a different team than the one I covered early in the season in February. Losses to Duke and a Carolina loss that was just abysmal. So Denver's much better. But Georgetown, I think, moves forward off this game. I'm actually encouraged because I think their young players are really, really good. And I just think that this was a step up for them. They hadn't seen anything like this. They're walking into enemy territory, playing against better players, a team that's hardened, seasoned, ready for them. So I think Georgetown's in a good spot. And again, I think they should be ranked anywhere from 8 to the 12, 13, 14 range. I think that, you know, that's their tier. That's what I see on tape. That's what I see on tape. That's all I got.
So you touched on this in two different instances. I think that Denver is a good example to talk about the conversation of live streams, what you should pay for, what you shouldn't have to pay for, what the changing landscape of cable networks and broadcast and conference affiliation actually means. My point of view, and then I'm interested in your reaction, is the advent of the Big Ten Network and then subsequently BTN Plus coincided with it preceded the creation of the ACC Network, at least with respect to the way it impacted lacrosse, by a couple years. And the creation of the ACC Network, which we would have felt the impact of in 2020 had the season not been canceled, and now we are feeling a fuller impact of it in terms of, you know, essentially, I think that BTN and the ACC Network have done one really good thing, which has gotten more lacrosse on television, and specifically more women's lacrosse on television. Now, with respect to the ACC Network, the downside is that some of those broadcasts would have otherwise ended up on ESPNU. And the difference there being that in the Mid-Atlantic, where Comcast is the largest cable provider, ACC Network's not available. And if you don't have an ACC Network subscription, you also can't watch ACC Network Extra, which is available through the ESPN app and a really easy, good way for a lot of lacrosse fans to watch those games. So, for example, I have DirecTV, and as a result, I have the ACC Network, which means that when I open my ESPN app, I can watch ACC Network games, or ACC Network Extra games on the ESPN app. The other thing that's happened is ESPN has aggregated a lot of conference rights. From last year to this year, they added the Patriot League, which means that it's even more justifiable for a lacrosse fan to spend $4.99 a month in order to access lacrosse games, which is good. However, prior to this, the Patriot League streams were free. So you are getting a better value proposition for your $5 if you choose to spend it because you get more games, but some of those games are games that you previously would have had access to for free. Denver has taken a little bit more of a university-based approach, but as you wrote in your poll this week, they do a really good job with their live streams. The camera quality is high. The commentating is high. You're able to see the action very clearly, but you have to pay for it. And coming away from they're playing the first game of the season against Utah, and then obviously some of their other home games since then, including their Georgetown game on Tuesday, that was kind of a lightning bolt or a lightning rod for this conversation. What do you think is a reasonable expectation for lacrosse fans?
Well, if you pay for it, it better be worth watching. You can't shoot it from the seventh floor of the press box. You can't shoot it with camera guys who can't follow the ball and the players look like ants. So get your cameras in position or your camera down low in position. You know, I point to that Army-Virginia game that was a one-camera shoot on their turf field covered by snow in the background. That camera guy is a former high school lacrosse player. He shot it from about 12 feet up in the air. He did an amazing job. Call up those highlights. Google them. Army-Virginia, it was a February game. You felt like you had the best seat in the house. Terrific. And there was no – there may have been commentary. I forget. But the highlights are – I've watched the highlights, and I thought the camera angle was incredible. So let's get better camera angles. And then the commentary. Keep it simple. I thought Eric Law, who was the analyst in that Denver-Georgetown game, was outstanding. A++. Really enjoyed listening to him. He had insights to Coach Tierney and the Denver team that was educating, was enlightening, and I loved it. They did a great job. So if you paid for that game, I think you walked away saying, yeah, I got my bang for my buck. Because you can't, if you're charging money, you can't deliver crap. I mean, it's as simple as that.
Moving along, Michigan 14, Penn State 12. This is an odd place to start when we're talking about a trio of Big Ten games, I understand. But I do think it's important because it was coming away from Michigan's loss to Ohio State a week ago Sunday. I think reasonable to wonder where Michigan was going to get their win, if they were going to get on the board this season and avoid an 0-10 outcome. They were hosting a Penn State team who had an additional day of rest and was motivated, presumably, coming off of a bad showing against Johns Hopkins at Homewood Field. And I thought that Michigan comported themselves well, primarily because of their ability to take a punch from Penn State and bounce back. And they particularly addressed an issue which had plagued them all year, which was bad third quarter performances. So after Penn State scored five straight goals between the first and second quarter to dig themselves out of an early hole and take a lead, Michigan was able to chip away with two goals late in the second quarter and then go on a third quarter run. Ultimately, I think their performance was attributable to cleanliness in the way that they played. They cleared at 85% after being at 75% coming into the season, into the game. And as a result, they were able to put Bryce Clay in a position to really showcase himself as a power dodger. And Josh Zawada is an exceptional, he's very slick, but I was very impressed by his ability to shoot from range. Those two accounted for 9 of Michigan's 14 goals. Penn State did a nice job keeping Mikey Bame in check. And the midfields, it remains an issue in terms of production, but they got a couple of timely goals from a couple of different guys. If they can get, you know, 2, 3, 4 points consistently from each their first and second midfield, then they could be okay. Penn State, on the other hand, continues to struggle in a bunch of different ways. And, you know, one of those significant ways is not only players who are lost for the season due to injury, but also just a incongruous season from a COVID standpoint.
You know, we were talking about it offline yesterday. If you go trying to go back and make comparisons from basketball or football, you know, I didn't think that Michigan football and Penn State football had great years. You know, there was high expectations. They never got off to a good start. They never seemed to grasp, you know, life in this COVID year. That appears to be happening at Ohio State, Michigan, or not Michigan now, but Penn State lacrosse. I would say those are the two of the most disappointing teams in the country. Considering preseason rank and current performance. It's a shame. Again, I don't want to speculate what it's been like for Coach Tamburoni. I had their game the other day, but you think about how much time these coaches are spending with non-lacrosse activities to just get everybody to get to practice was the quote he used. You know, just get to practice, get to practice, get to practice. And every day it looks different. So it's hard to grow. Luckily there's a second half of the season and they'll turn it around, and Michigan ends the first half. This is a big boost for them. I mean, this is huge because I watched their Ohio State game and I thought Cotter and Clark were really positive about them. And so that kind of caught my ear. They kept mentioning how Michigan didn't go away in that game and how that can carry over. And I was a little hesitant to agree with that, but they were right. They're very right. Because Michigan, did take a step forward. Zawada's a great player. Love watching him play.
The reason I wanted to talk about this game is because at 10 a.m. on Sunday on ESPNU, although it finished on ESPN News, Penn State versus Michigan's women's team played, and I think it's a nice opportunity to bring up the issue of gender equity, which was all over social media last week with respect to unequal treatment and amenities and approaches of the between the NCAA men's basketball tournament and the NCAA women's basketball tournament. And it's a conversation that is certainly not going to change or go away or anything like that. It's going to continue to progress as advocates for women's sports continue to demand more. And I think it's an important lesson for lacrosse fans to be mindful of, because since I've been involved in lacrosse, one of the overriding storylines or comments when it comes to men's and women's lacrosse is that they're different games. That is something that you hear from advocates for both sports. That is a losing perspective. The sports, both men's and women's lacrosse, will benefit from a more conjoined point of view on pushing the sport forward together going forward in ways that other sports, be it hockey or basketball or baseball and softball, don't necessarily benefit from on the upside. And the other thing that I'll say is these women's lacrosse games are awesome. Like, Molly Garrett was one of the most impressive players I've seen all season long. Not just women's lacrosse players. Like, the one of the most impressive college lacrosse players I've seen all season long. I believe she finished with 7. Her 5th goal was a right-to-left split down the alley, and she hammered the far pipe with an offhand shot. And then one of the elements of this game that was so exciting was, so Michigan gets a free position shot to tie the game with 7 seconds left. The shot goes high. They have an end line restart and find Garrett on the doorstep for a quick stick finish with 2 seconds left. It was so dramatic. Game goes to overtime. Michigan gets the ball first. Ultimately, they weren't able to convert. Penn State comes down. Olivia Dirks, I think, got the first look, and it couldn't tell whether it hit the pipe or it was a save, but ultimately, Penn State wins it in overtime off of a nice time and room shot from the high slot that was really well placed off hip. And it was an important win for Penn State because the women's Big Ten teams, who are also playing conference only, are doing 2-game and 3-day series. And Michigan had won on Friday. So to come back for Penn State and get the win on Sunday was really important. And ultimately, just a really good symbol of the fact that, you know, advocating for women's lacrosse is a really important thing for men's lacrosse fans, men's lacrosse players, and men's lacrosse coaches to understand the importance of. And I think that, you know, folks in your position and mine need to get on board with it. And I know that you've called a number of women's games as well. So I'm interested in your thoughts on the distinction between men's and women's lacrosse and how both sports benefit from supporting each other going forward.
I agree with that. I think the more we can do to have doubleheaders, to combine championship weekends, to make tournaments feel like one product, to weave the coverage of a women's tournament game into a men's tournament game, into studio or back and forth. I think that's only a plus in terms of gaining fans. There's no reason that who's most likely to be a women's lacrosse fan? Probably a men's lacrosse fan, ex-player, parent, because there's just a built-in understanding of these games. The women's game is unbelievable. I mean, I did that High Point Duke game. The playmaking, the speed, the athletic ability is just off the charts compared to what it used to be. Again, the game's got a little too many whistles, and the women's lacrosse has done a great job addressing some of their shortcomings in the rules. They've made, you know, changes to the possession clock. They've really opened the game up and done a fabulous job. They've taken ownership of it and improved it, and that's awesome. I'm lucky to do those women's games, and that's something I really look forward to. It's really cool because there's something there as a fan, you know. I think you see the crossovers, you see strategy, you see these longtime coaches in the women's game who have just are incredible people and incredible leaders that I like to be around.
Moving along, Rutgers 15, Johns Hopkins 9. You mentioned Ohio State and Penn State are two of the more disappointing teams that you've seen so far this year. Bar none, Rutgers being 4-1 and a bona fide top 5 team in the country is the biggest surprise in the positive end for me. And this was a big result in both Rutgers' ability to rebound from their first loss of the season last week at College Park, as well as stifle some of the progress that we thought we saw from the Blue Jays in their win over Penn State. Kieran Mullins, 5 goals and 3 assists. Adam Shrelambides, 3 goals and 2 assists. Garrett Degnan led the way for the Blue Jays with 3-1. Connor DeSimone had 2-2. What were your thoughts on this one, Quint?
Just as you said, the biggest question I had in this game is Rutgers' maturity coming off the loss to Maryland. You know, they've been a pretty hyped team this year. How would they react to that loss? And this is exactly what you look for from a growth and a maturity standpoint. They answered the question here, especially in the second half, where they diced up the Hopkins defense pretty good. So they're legit. You know, they're a legit second best team in the Big Ten. They're a playoff at large, definite at large right now, and that's about it in the Big Ten. So they keep holding serve over the lower portion. They're a team that's in the NCAA tournament, and they right now, to me, they look like a first-round winner. I mean, they look like a team that can win a game in that round of 16, without a doubt, and then they'd be in a dogfight in the quarters.
Rutgers is a good team to talk about the NCAA transfer portal, which was a little bit of a hot-button topic this week, as Albany coach Scott Maher, to local media, when asked about T.D. Erlin and his ability to play this weekend for Denver, a game that was ultimately postponed due to COVID issues within the Villanova program, talked about how he didn't like the transfer portal's ability to allow a player to essentially put his name in the portal without having a conversation with his coach. Rutgers, in the way that Villanova expected Connor Kearse to come back when last season was shut down and ultimately he changed his mind a couple months later and joined this program, he's become their third leading scorer with 14 goals and 8 assists. And it is certainly, in my opinion, the linchpin to the matchup issues, because there aren't a lot of 230-pound Dodgers in college lacrosse that require the level of defensive attention that Connor Kearse requires. He's not the only newcomer making a contribution for this Scarlet Knight team. Quint, what's your point of view on the transfer portal, both in terms of what it has changed since its creation or formation, and whether or not it should be tweaked in order to find a better balance?
I'm all for the transfer portal. I'm all for player movement, student-athlete movement, because if I'm a normal student going to Binghamton University and I decide that school's not for me, I just pick up and leave and go somewhere else. Why should playing athletics and receiving a scholarship bind me to be at that school? So I'm all for player movement. I'm all for the transfer portal. Now, this pandemic has added the extra class, okay? 5 classes into 4. It's created some bloated rosters. It's created some overstocked rosters. It's created some scholarship issues. When I have a good player late in his career, a bad player late in his career eating a lot of scholarship money, I don't want him on my roster. I got to get rid of this guy. So I'm all for, as a coach, I'm all for the transfer portal. Get him out of here. Free up his scholarship money. I want to get some new fresh blood in here. It has created almost a free agent department within these college athletic departments, because they've got to be evaluating the talent from around the country. They've got to be really keen on their salary cap, meaning their scholarships. How much money do we have? How much money? I mean, when Chris Gray became available, that was a big deal. Carolina had the money. Carolina had the right timing to have the money to offer Chris Gray, and that's really what separated him from about 2 or 3 other programs. So having money available, roster management is just a huge part of what these coaches have to do now. And then player retention. Player retention's got to be, you know, you got to keep your good players. How do you do that? You got to keep them happy. I mean, that is so out of the job description from what a college lacrosse coach did 10 years ago, that it's mind-boggling. That's the reality. That's where we're living. And those that can adapt will succeed.
Quickly on the last game of the Big Ten slate this past weekend, Maryland 16, Ohio State 8. This was a game that I believe Ohio State closed to 8-6, either early in the second quarter, late in the second quarter, early in the third, and a John Geppert goal ended up sparking Maryland's run that allowed them to separate. In your poll, you noted that this is an outlier result with respect to this series since the Big Ten's formation. And ultimately, you know, portends some continuing issues within the Ohio State program as they play without Ryan Tarafenko, but also, you know, continue to look for different ways to improve.
Again, that surprised me. When you go back since Ohio State's joined the Big Ten, all these games have been 3 goals or less. For whatever reason, Ohio State has given Maryland everything they can handle. And I thought Maryland coming off the big win at Rutgers may have been vulnerable. If this game had a Vegas line, I would have been probably siding – it probably would have been, what, Maryland 4.5 or 5 or 6 goals, somewhere in that range. Probably 4, 4.5.
Yeah.
And I would have said, you know what? Ohio State historically has given this team a lot of fits. Ohio State just picked up momentum beating Michigan. Maryland may be vulnerable. Like, I would have sided with Ohio State in the intangibles here. But it shows you how impressive Maryland's been. This team is like flat-lined excellence. They just march on. It's a good team. I love their depth of scoring this week. Got some new names in this, you know, not all reliant on Wisnowskis and Jared Bernhardt, which is a plus.
So Maryland is now 5-0. Would you bet yes, no, they go 5-0 in the second half of their Big Ten schedule?
I would have to say yes.
So one of the elements of this, because I've found it very interesting, this whole, you know, you play 5 games and then you play everybody a second time. To me, I would say sports are sports and they're unpredictable. When you're the team that beat the opponent in the first matchup, you're more vulnerable. Yeah. Ultimately, like, what I'm getting at is the big caveat here is COVID availability. And there are two factors. This is the last kind of hot button topic that I've got planned. There are two factors in terms of the likelihood of a positive test or subsequent contact tracing. Number one, whether athletes have had it already, have had the virus already, and there were large outbreaks among a lot of these teams in the fall, such that there's some built-in immunity. I don't think that there is consistent, I think there is within conferences, but across the country, I don't think there's a consistent way to handle contact tracing for a player who has already had it the way, say, the NBA has a policy that distinguishes between whether or not you've previously had the virus. But then separately, and this is the question that I have for you, so we're weeks away from eligibility restrictions loosening all across the country for resident citizens under the age of 65. University settings, particularly those that are associated with large hospital systems, of which there are many, are probably incredibly efficient ways to get a lot of people vaccinated very quickly. Would you have an issue with college athletes being relatively first in line for receiving the vaccine once folks under the age of 65 are eligible?
Once the general population under the age of 65 is eligible, I would have no problem with that. But to give a college athlete any kind of preferential treatment, I'm very much against.
I do know that in some programs, vaccinations have already started to be administered to players. And again, all these restrictions vary state to state. So there are some places where that is within the current eligibility standards. And it'll be interesting, specifically coming off of a, you know, NCAA March Madness weekend in which we saw VCU have to forfeit, essentially, and have their season end and Oregon advance through the first round by virtue of a COVID issue. Looking forward to both a men's and women's lacrosse tournament and whether or not COVID issues could ruin a team's chances, because you can't reschedule tournament games the way you can reschedule regular season games.
Here's the deal.
The way in which the race to vaccination could impact that, I think, is a really important and interesting conversation.
Two items from over the weekend that are relevant. NCAA hockey bracket of 16 released. NCAA hockey stated that in their selection process, they would have alternative teams ready on hold. So the brackets assembled. They give one or two teams as alternate status. And then if somebody in that bracket by, I think it's Tuesday or Wednesday, says, we can't compete, we've got a COVID issue, then someone else gets slotted in. So don't be surprised if in lacrosse you see some alternatives. And then once that bracket goes final, let's say Wednesday or Thursday, it becomes a forfeit. It becomes a no contest like you saw with VCU. Other thing I want to mention, Terry, is Navy. You know, Navy hasn't played a lacrosse game since February 28th. Quarantine, lockdown, Bancroft Hall. Interesting, though, that Navy wrestlers were at the NCAA championships, tested all week long, wrestled. I flew with them back to Annapolis yesterday. They were on my flight, my Southwest flight, talking to Kerry Colot about it. So it's an interesting dynamic is you have a campus that's virtual, basically on lockdown. You have these athletes who've tested negative over an entire week, and they get thrown back in that mix, and they're asked to stay locked down. It's like, why are we testing and then locking people down? So I think that's some of these campus-wide outbreaks and that slash with lacrosse players who are testing daily, it's a little befuddling to me.
I lied. I do have one more hot-button issue that I want to talk about. We talked about it early in the season on this podcast. Loyola 24, Bucknell 10, a league game. In an offensive explosion, you noted that it's the most goals Loyola has scored since, I believe, 1997, when they put up 24 on Fairfield, and noted the return of Joey Kamish, who had been injured since after the week after the Richmond game. The issue of running up the score in lacrosse is a new conversation in a shot clock era. How do you feel about the question of how many goals is too many?
I think once you get past 27, 28, I think I have an issue with teams scoring more than that.
And what is the margin that's acceptable? So say, for instance,
there's a shot clock. Like, so if you're
up 21-17 with 8 minutes to go, 21, no issue with
17. It's close.
Yeah, no issue keeping score. So keep scoring.
Look, I got a shot clock. I got a gigantic roster. I got some guys who haven't played this season. I can't put my third string attack out there and tell them to throw the ball around and take a shot clock violation and roll the ball into the corner, can I?
No.
I mean, you know,
complicated.
Again, this is Division I lacrosse. We're giving out scholarships for this. Like, this is not high school, MCLA. You know, as long as it's not done with bad will, I think even the losing coach has to understand that, like, they're not doing anything that's unsportsmanlike. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that ultimately, if you're a college coach, you say, hey, man, get a stop. Like, that's what it comes down to. And I understand that, you know, there's a difference between stalling in perpetuity versus stalling for 80 seconds. But I think that all of these... Whenever the losing side coach has an issue with the choices that the winning side coach made, typically it's pretty nuanced, right? It's very rare that you see that Adams State, Johnson and Wales 52-4 score or whatever we were talking about a couple years ago.
Like, exactly. It's a subtlety, Terry. It's like, yeah, they subbed, but they kept their first FOGO in and won every faceoff. Like, they didn't sub the faceoff guy. Like, I get texts during games. I was getting texts when Duke was beating High Point. By that gargantuan score, was it 27 or whatever, the 2-2 game that went to 16-2. I got text during that game that accused Duke of not subbing proficient enough, okay, during the game, and people wanting me to call Duke out for not subbing. I looked on the field, and I saw backups, J.P. Pazil, the other Robertson, Cam Ulay, like that's the last time I checked, those guys aren't starters and they were torching High Point. So I took those texts and deleted them so fast your head would spin.
Quint, we will wind down this quick restart podcast with a final thought. Anything you've got to add
great
as
week
we
coming up?
That's exactly what I was hoping you were going to say.
Yeah, we got to go forward here. We got some really good action on TV this week, Thursday. What do you got? Syracuse, Duke coming up. You got Notre Dame, Virginia. You got a Rutgers, Maryland game on ESPNU. So it's a fantastic TV week.
That'll do it for this edition of the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. We really appreciate you checking it out. Make sure to tune in later in the week as we will have more Inside Lacrosse Podcasts. And of course, we'll be back next week with a new edition of the Quick Restart.
We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. That whistle, right?